Well, welcome, everyone. Thanks for your promptness. I appreciate it. I hope you're having a good time with the launch of a new system and beginning to look at things in a new way. I'm eager to hear what kind of thoughts or questions or reflections you have after you've had a chance for our first seminar to kind of marinate and to really look at some of the material and the curriculum. Your thoughts or questions or things that would be helpful for us to talk about. Anyone? Let me ask if you would manage the background noise. I hear some breathing into the receiver. You're probably not hearing it, but if you would manage the background noise so that we can keep an open discussion for the entire time. Any thoughts or questions that any of you have about the material or just the beginning experience of launching into this for what you're experiencing, especially in terms of what you expected?
Well, I just this is Olga. Hi, how are you?
Please, thank you. Go ahead. I was getting lonely there for a minute. Go ahead.
I just had a quick question about compromises and not much in the second seminar. Are compromises negative? Are they negative? Because it says here about that we have to take an inventory of our compromises, right? So when
yes, okay.
In a relationship, is a compromise a negative thing, or is that something you still have to take inventory of? Is that
okay, that's a good question. In the context of that exercise particularly, and in considering your story, it's a compromise in terms of less than an optimum achievement or pursuit of the ideals or the goals of your story. Now, I'm not talking about compromise in terms of relationships or interpersonal context where compromises are always necessary and you have, you know, two people, each of whom have something the other needs to grow more of, and they catalyze that and facilitate it and engage in relationships which contain compromise. But as part of strategy and negotiation. But I'm really talking about an individual story and not living fully into that story or having ideals that are attainable, clear, and precise. So anything that interferes with the fulfillment of one's own individual goals and the fulfillment of that story is what I'm really referring to.
Okay.
Does that make sense now?
It makes sense. Thank you.
And that's just, you know, the exercise is simply a way to kind of concretize that, to look at specifics, because so much of the detail and the need to look at the specifics is there instead of making it general or abstract. And that's the same challenge we have when in working with clients. If they are at the level of abstraction, you know, well, I think I need a career change, or I want to be happier, or I want to make more money. We need to move into more tangible, specific, concrete sort of things that they can do, things that can be action items, shrink the change to smaller steps, and look at tangible, specific goals. The SMART goals, you know, the acronym.
Specific, measurable.
Exactly,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So great question. Thanks. Other thoughts or things that would be helpful to discuss? I'm going to send around a sample of a write-up using the roadmap case study format. We don't do an exam, as I mentioned, but the only requirement for the specialty certification, the licensing, is to do a completed study. Everyone who has done it in the past found it was very useful. You can either do it on yourself or on a client. And then I'd like to devote up to, you know, 15 minutes or so of a later seminar for discussion of each of your roadmap case studies. And I'll send you an example of a write-up. And it's a short write-up, 750 to 1,200 words, like 3 pages, along the format of the roadmap. And it's a little premature right now because we're just going to begin today to discuss the first three steps of the roadmap. So after we get some discussion and experience going in the latter half of the seminar series, I'd like to get each of you to send in and then discuss, send around to each of us and then discuss a roadmap case study. Any questions about that or anything else that would be helpful for us to talk about?
This is Amy. Hello.
Yeah, hey, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding what she was just talking about, compromise. Was that in Module 1?
No, Module.
No. Where is it? The compromise is in, I think it's in Module 1, isn't it?
It's in Module 2.
Module 2, okay, yeah, I don't have that right in front of me right now. Yeah, so that's ahead of where we are right now.
Okay, thank goodness. I was trying to figure out.
We're still on Module 1? I'm sorry.
We are beginning to do Module 1 because that's the first three steps of the roadmap process.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. All right. I feel better. All right, thank you.
Yeah, okay, great.
I feel like
yeah.
Okay.
What else? Well, I'll begin with the seminar, and don't hesitate to interrupt or clarify something as it goes along, and then we'll have plenty of time to discuss at the end. So we've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new story. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. The steps are simple, but they're not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about our lives and the way we construct our story. For example, it may involve breaking bad or outdated habits, which involves departing a comfort zone, developing new ideas, the discomfort of the unknown, and remaining disciplined over the long haul. So in this seminar, we'll discuss the first three steps of the roadmap process to create a new life story. Recognize authorship, own your story, and assess the plot and storylines. And remember, the seven steps are a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So initially, they're simply ways to listen to a story and engage with someone in discussing and exploring it. So first, let's talk a little bit about operating systems. You're aware of how computers have operating systems. Within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex system of software that contains instructions, protocols, couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Your life story, each story within that, your career story, wellness story, money story, have an internal operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions about your behaviors. So we're about to deconstruct that system in order to study it, understand it, for you to decide what needs editing, rewriting, or simply updating. So first step, recognize authorship of your life story. Remember the premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. Yet so often the story closest to us, our own, can be the most difficult to know, to be objective about. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how do we tell our stories to ourselves to know what to keep and what to change? Now, your clients will probably recognize in a way that they author their own stories, but as you listen, you'll hear a belief or an assumption that ghostwrites a story that can be limiting, that the client just doesn't really take ownership of. I'm going to give you an example in a minute of an elephant who's an elephant in every way except for one little belief. So there are four principles, and all this is in your outline, so you don't have to do a bunch of writing so you can really just kind of listen and see what makes sense. Four principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. And if you want to get to what someone's core belief is, you can simply say, yeah, but how do you really know that? Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong, proportionate to the baby elephant, and it can't. So the baby elephant has to stay in the area determined by the length of rope. When this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6-7 tons, it could easily break the rope. But it doesn't, because earlier as a baby it couldn't. This huge adult elephant is constrained by his assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines his behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. And some things you have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. Remember the breaking of the 4-minute mile and the two anthropologists. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, what we register, and then how we process it. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. If, for example, you believe no one will love you, you'll interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way and act so that you won't be lovable or will block someone from experiencing intimacy or block yourself. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Also, kind of a sidebar here, select carefully the people you spend time with. It's been said that you're the average of the 5 people you're around the most. Do you like the results? Are they kind, successful, disciplined, achievers, or whatever your particular ideals and values are? Do you like the results? One oversimplified version, are they winners or losers? Choose your friends and colleagues well. It makes a difference. We're going to talk about the impact of that and some fascinating studies when we get to the wellness component and module. Principle three, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. This is one principle that distinguishes coaching, the focus on now and next. An application here. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you can affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. For example, when you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking people if they intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise. In the basic coaching model, remember, the final step of each session is to frame an action plan for the next week, initiated by the client, that the client intends, commits to do. Principle 4. Our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of whatever we perceive, even if it's not cause or effect. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but when asked for a reason, they readily give one, something that makes logical and conscious sense. For example, a series of studies by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard showed volunteers words flashed on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was subliminal conditioning. It was such a short time that they were unaware that the words were shown, and they couldn't pick them out or guess from a multiple choice. But they were influenced by them, and they were influenced by them for 40 to 55 minutes after the words were flashed for 1/50th of a second. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would then judge others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform slightly less well on tests. Now, when they were asked why they would judge or walk or score the way they did, of course they didn't know, but they would always give some reason. And the reasons made conscious and logical sense, but they weren't causal whatsoever. For example, they would first deny that they had done anything different, that there was anything that would affect them. But when they were shown, for example, on film, the way they walked before and after the instantaneous flash, the word elderly, and they actually saw themselves walk a little bit slower and told why it was, they said, well, no, you know, I was just a little tired when I did the test, or I've been traveling for the last few days and I haven't slept well, or I'm jet-lagged. They made some reason that made it make conscious and logical sense, even though it was not cause and effect. They were not aware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. Now, this demonstrates how our minds bring closure and how our brains want to end dissonance by a causal explanation. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete can trump accurate even. So this is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, kind of like a finish without an ending. My current blog that's available at my blog site, or actually on the bottom part of my homepage of MentorPath, is about mistaking correlation for causality. Might be an interesting read if you haven't seen that. So in the workbook, review especially the exercise in step one, recognize authorship of your story. You'll see that the self-quizzes there focus on major areas, needs, ideals, relationships, career, identity, or sense of self. And plot simply means the core themes and storylines of life stories that inform what we look for and how we attribute meaning to what we find. Now, here's an example of someone recognizing authorship. A woman wrote me after reading my book, Destiny, An Uncommon Journey. It's an allegory of self-development with destiny, the ship undergoing transformation inside and outside. She said, that could be a profile of my life. I'm sure a lot of people experience the same thing. I don't want to relive this pattern over and over again. There seems to be this circuitry that I keep entering. Destiny had to trust in order to learn. When will I learn to trust? I just keep peeling back more layers. How many layers to these distortions are there? She elaborated about how frustrating several therapies had been for many years with different therapists. I wrote back the following response, and this may sound a little familiar. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs ghostwrite that story. When you peel back all the layers of the onion, what's left is not a pure, unadulterated onion, but nothing, since you've destroyed the object of the quest. Instead of the model of layers going deeper to discover the next layer, consider generating a new story. Going forward rather than backward. possibilities rather than problems. You can even assess when you're rewriting an old story and plagiarizing an earlier version of yourself. Then you can edit the repeating storyline or create a new one. She decided to work together in coaching for a few months to create a new story. She now writes stories for a major U.S. publication and is working on a second screenplay. She asked me as I ended, as we ended the coaching engagement, if I would be in the audience when she was nominated for an Academy Award. Step two, own your story. And especially I want to highlight the exercise, Assumptions and Motivations Constructing Storylines. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package, and we have many packages. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. So there are two principles here that are important in coaching that I want to take a moment to mention. One is that the most common mistake that people make in trying to change is simply to add something new, to add a new pattern, instead of disrupting the pattern that exists that they don't want to have in place and instituting the new one instead. Simply adding on a pattern to the ones that already exist most likely won't have an effect. And this is important. We've touched on this before, and we'll come back to it in the P, Roadmap, Program New Identity. When you work with someone and help them address a change of behavior, the most common facet of our personality structure is that we return to our core identity. So this means that if someone just simply does something different and we don't address how they see themselves, that core identity, then they're likely to return to that and change won't last. So we have to help someone incorporate that change as part of a transformation of the model they're using as well as their behavior, something that affects their core identity. So as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be useful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So what that means is if someone has a performance that they feel is compromised or not what they want, look at the antecedent, look at the behavior that comprises that, and look at what needs to change. If someone has a behavior that is not working or compromised in some way, look at the beliefs that they have that generate that behavior. Look at the antecedent to look at what needs to change. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I'll find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs, even though they may be part of the shadow story and not even conscious, can influence reality and behavior. Limiting beliefs have an effect emotionally and physically. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. So the way that you figure out how to adapt or survive is usually the way you continue to adapt or survive. The first survival strategy usually becomes a favorite and becomes hardwired. But favorite even implies a choice. First, you have to experience it as a choice rather than as just the way things are. And this is what's important in recognizing and owning one's story, is to recognize that what seems like just the way things are is exactly how you're writing it from the perspective of your experience. Now, notice these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. A specific example. We're in a unique position as coaches to observe patterns. The brain seeks patterns. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. And one example is attachment patterns, the behavior patterns that we have in terms of connection to important people and the way we play out those attachment patterns. Now, here's a kind of a brief and vivid example of this, but think about the human equivalents. I recently raised a hatching of wild ducks, mallards, in a pen that I constructed at my ranch. Now, the pen was necessary to protect them from critters until they got old enough to fend for themselves and flee danger by flying, especially since I'm there only on the weekends. This necessitated living in the pen, partly submerged in the water at the edge of the lake, so they could practice swimming, so they could develop naturally for about 5 weeks. When I opened the gate of the pen, they wouldn't leave. You know, I thought they'd be so excited to get the hell out of there and fly away. Despite their freedom to swim in one of a couple of beautiful lakes, they hunkered in the pen. They would not leave. Confinement in the pen had become a comfort zone. I had to force them out. I had to literally pick the pen up on its end and tump them out. Then, as soon as they were released, all 12 moved in a group, never more than a few inches apart, kind of in a little tight circle pattern, a habit they formed in the pen. They continued to swim and fly in that very tight pattern for a very long time. So think about your attachment patterns, the default behaviors of your relationships with important people. Some may have been etched early on with essential people in your life. Even though it's a default mode, even though you've incorporated it as a model, perhaps even used it with your children or spouse, it's still a choice. You can choose to continue or choose another pattern, another habit. Just because you have a history with someone doesn't mean you have to keep repeating it. In fact, I will, one of the white papers that I did for the mentor group, remember I mentioned that we do a mentor group every quarter, and there would be a white paper. One of the white papers I did for a mentor group last year was on attachment patterns, and I'll send you that just to see if it might be useful to you to consider in working with clients. Now, an example of this, to bring this to an example, and again, I'll hesitate to stop and clarify and jot down any questions you have for our discussion at the end. I was working with a CEO of a successful company that he founded. His son had a condition that if he took medication, he could remain without symptoms. He had bipolar disorder, but his son wouldn't take the medication. His son was a PhD, I think he was 32 at that time, and he had been hospitalized already 6 times since his early 20s, and he was about to be hospitalized again, lost his teaching position in the university, and my client was about to repeat the pattern he'd engaged in each of the 6 times that his son had been hospitalized to rescue him. He had orchestrated the equivalent of a midnight helicopter rescue from a Mexican prison each time. He would put his COO in charge of operating the country. He would sort of pick up stakes and go live in an apartment for 2 or 3 months minimum nearby to his son where he was hospitalized and help him get back on his feet and do the various things. And as we looked at this, and I questioned him carefully, he acknowledged that his efforts had really made no difference. And it especially made no difference in terms of the self-care and self-regulation of his son to take medication and act responsibly. So my client was enhancing his sense of helplessness that had by now affected his health and the effectiveness of running his company by focusing on what he could determine, what he could not determine. He could not determine how his son responded, and abandoned the things for that period of time, at least, that he could determine. So he needed for himself and for his son to stop rescuing. So part of what we did in coaching was as we went over this and looked at this carefully, and he saw very clearly that it didn't work. I also recommended, because I knew his wife was part of the system, that he and his wife attend CODA meetings for support, Codependents Anonymous, for people who have loved ones who will not take care of themselves, and get the support in that group and really listen from different perspectives to what people had learned from doing what he needed to do. So ultimately, my client was able to let go, and he was one of the most loving dads I've ever known, so it was really tough for him. Fast forward. His son is now taking medication, consistently for the first time in his adult life since that episode about 5 or 6 years ago. He has not had a relapse, has not had any difficulty whatsoever, has a faculty position, and has started a family. And this is the longest period that he's gone since his first diagnosis in his early 20s, and he's committed to never having a relapse. So a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. And that precept is this. In adulthood, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. And that's something at times that you may have to challenge a client with, that they just want the boss to change. They want somebody else to change. They want a situation to be different. They are bemoaning an entire system there. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that by talking first about point of reference, because point of reference is a basic concept of storytelling and writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. This theme can include passivity or resignation. Their experience is often helplessness. They can transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. So here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating, reacting rather than initiating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Now, some of these are way too easy for me to say. They believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. And when they experience, for example, a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like, or deny it altogether. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and disengaging the connection rather than pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference, and this is what we coach toward. Every one of the examples I just gave, for me, are coachable moments. This is what we coach toward, to develop an internal point of reference, an internal source of authority, to see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. And here are some of those characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. They keep their feathers oiled if they're ducks. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. Remember, we talked about the fundamental premise of coaching is, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, a related notion to this is to recognize active versus passive positions. And what I'm really talking about is related to how I think we can get at least as much, and I believe somewhat more information by working with someone by telephone than in person. Now, we lose some of the visual cues, but we develop other ways of listening, other kinds and points of data and information. And there's not the distraction of face-to-face. So active versus passive positions. This is how somebody constructs their language, but it tells you where they are vis-a-vis themselves and their own authority. Sometimes a story just seems to write itself, to just happen to someone. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. Every one of these, again, a coachable moment, which is why I have the agreement with someone that I can interrupt at any time, because as soon as somebody says this, I want to look at it with them, because that's how they're constructing their story, and that's an immediate way to look at that, an immediate window to a very important concept. So you have to eliminate all the outs. And remember the anthropologist, the idea of a gun was enough to change everything. Now, these passive positions disown the feelings, thoughts, or action as an active creation, as if the feeling you create makes you its victim. This passivity can mask personal initiative. So, rather than managing or overcoming or countering or medicating a feeling, such as anxiety, the first step is to acknowledge that even though it seemed to just happen, you generate the experience. You create the feeling. Then you can examine the meaning you attach. Insight and understanding alone do not generate a positive, successful new story. You create it. So, once recognizing and owning your story, first two steps, step three, assess the storylines and plot. Now, this is something I didn't learn in high school. We didn't learn in high school. I didn't learn this in medical school. A belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in someone's brain. It's a physical part of a neuronal network and pathway system. A teacher can't simply present an explanation and remove an existing neural network in his student's brain, or present something and expect it to overwrite what's already there, which is why we see the remarkable statistics we do about expert consultants. You know, you've probably heard me give the example before. Take any model of professional consultancy, physician, attorney, CPA, financial advisor. You go to a physician and you're motivated by pain. You have a desire to change. You're scared. You go through all the trouble of schlepping across town and parking away. When a physician, and this is a measurable component of this, a clear metric, when a physician gives a prescription, slightly less than 50% of those prescriptions are filled. Then, once they're filled, slightly less than 50% of those are actually complied with as directed. So even when somebody's highly motivated, sees an expert, less than 25% of people follow that advice. Of people who are new in an ICU, intensive care unit, after a myocardial infarction, after a heart attack, they are advised very strongly and carefully and with consideration about needing to change major things like nutrition, exercise, manner of diet, if they hope to have a longer life or a decent life expectancy. How many people do you think change under those frightening, life-threatening circumstances? 1 in 9. So that's why just giving information doesn't really work that well. Why change is hard, and why we have to take into account, I believe, how the mind and brain work. So you can't just list three reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network and neuronal pathways, or expecting that presenting a new fact is going to overwrite the one already there. But change is a process. Not an event. It's an inside job. It occurs within a relationship. So the first step may be to perturbate beliefs or to assess beliefs to see if they're limiting. What's another way of looking at this? How might your thoughts be limiting you? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there questions you're afraid to ask? And remember, denial is a powerful engagement. So is a secret. You're engaged with it in a powerful way. What do you really want? What do you need to let go of? I want to highlight in the workbook portion, the two exercises on needs and ideals. Of all the exercises, when I work with a client, I will most likely request that my client complete the needs and the ideals exercise and send me the three most important needs and three most important ideals that she or he has. And I'll put those inside the front cover of that client's chart so that we're both aware of the strategies and the goals that we collaborate and develop are aligned with core values, core needs. So ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. And ideals are the internal standard of excellence. They're a personal model of value. They're an internal guide to purpose, to our why. And living up to a personal, attainable ideal is the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from. Living up to that ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. Failure to live up to an internal ideal results in feeling shame. And that's the most intolerable, most difficult affect that we can have because it means we're failing to live up to who we want to be, not just something we've done that we can, you know, undo or defend or in some other way. But it's a core and fundamental. We'll return to that. And needs now are important. You can get sick if you don't have enough of a need. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. And unmet, frustrated needs create discomfort. And needs don't go away just because they don't get met. So, and needs can evolve over time. Meeting a need can move one along in the hierarchy to move to another need. Ideals really don't fundamentally change. They're your why. They remain as the internal generator of purpose. But needs can evolve as they're met. I want to give you a vignette to illustrate how it's important to clarify needs and ideals and align them with a client's goals. And as a sidebar here, notice how much we can learn just from someone's language and behavior, the assumptions that drive their stories. And that's also a secondary reason I want to present just this little vignette. The client said, "I feel like I've been cheated at the end of the day. It's 9:00 at night, and I haven't eaten yet most days. That's the way my schedule goes. I come home from work, my wife hands our son to me, and I'm in charge of him from 5 to 7. Now, I love that, but I'm tired. She needs the time to do her computer work. Then I finish work from the day, and it's at least 9:00. I'm stressed out." I highlighted two aspects of exactly what he said. I've been cheated, and the way my schedule is. I pointed out that he was speaking as if he were not writing his own story, as if it were being ghostwritten by someone else and not even approved by him. And I knew he was in charge of his own schedule. Then I asked him simply, "Let's look at why you're writing your story each day in a way that you don't like." He paused. He was kind of dumbfounded. He said, "Well, you're right, but I guess I feel like I have to. I feel like I have to support my wife, have to take care of our son in that way. My work just spills into the evening, into my private life. So I don't work out. I don't even relax. I even have to take calls from my people during the time with my son. Something is assumed and expected of me when I walk in the door. I feel like somebody else is in control of me." And I said, "What do you hear yourself saying?" And he paused and thought. He said, "Well, it's like, in your language, somebody else is writing my story for me." I said, "You're not acting like you own your story or your company." He said, "Well, how can I protect my time with my son?" And I said, "Every yes you have to pay for with at least one no. Those yeses are getting pretty expensive. No protected time to be totally with him, for him and you. No total immersion in free play." And I said, "Let's start at the beginning. Every day is a blank page, and nothing's on it until you write it. How ideally would you like your day to unfold?" Well, he began actively structuring his day, proactively rather than reacting to each of the things that came up and to each of the people, each of his managers who would grab him and do a curbside consult or had a brush fire they needed to put out, and actively constructed this to let everyone in his organization know what his schedule was and how they would fit into it, certain times of the day that he would take calls, certain times of the day that he would meet with his managers, and so on. So he then constructed a day in which he was in charge of his schedule. He proactively decided the structures, the boundaries, the parameters. He even worked in, at my nudging, exercise. And I said, I hear you beginning to write a different story, to take care of yourself. It's also a powerful model for your son, for him to see fully how a man can take care of himself and others. So his day, including the exercise, ended at 5 o'clock, and when he came home, he was 100% at home to be with his son and with his wife. Now, when he was really getting it, reflecting on what we were saying, I decided to add something. I said, I want to share a hunch with you to see if it's useful for us to consider. I suspect the frustrations that you haven't spoken until now about your company, your marriage, are there at a subliminal level and get communicated so that others feel it, your wife, your employees, your customers. I'd guess it registers as something not working quite right, and you or they don't know exactly why until it lights on something that makes it make sense, even though it's not the real cause. He thought for a minute. He said, yeah, like when I blow up or when I fire somebody. And I said, well, that would end the tension for a while. He said, yeah, but then I'm off to the races again. So he recognized that when he structured a way to meet his own needs, structured his professional day, and structured his personal day, and took care of the foundation of his wellness, that he was creating a personal and professional mastery. By having clear boundaries, he could be totally immersed in work during the day, totally free at home. Both were restorative for him, and he functioned significantly better in both arenas. Now, another part of the assessment of a life story, to understand conflicted, or any story actually, to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. So when you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The map, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So, and this is something I don't think we quite talk about enough in coaching. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. So a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. For example, and we've touched on this before, if you read the anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. A current paradigm can reframe the excitement and trepidation of moving ahead in new territory as a signpost of progress. Another example, we need to be afraid of the right thing. We often fear what's readily remembered, the emotional impact and the recency effect. Something's more recent, so it has more salience, more valence. We fear also what we perceive we can't control. For example, it's a lot more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in the seat of an airplane, we feel no control and often more anxious. Another example, smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People also fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that can clog arteries and cause heart attacks. Now, one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to self-reflect, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they still work well for us or if they need to be revised. So, listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, group, or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside, so pay attention to what you consistently like or dislike in another. And don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Acknowledge and own everything about yourself. Take yourself very personally. Listen carefully and explicitly to all the messages from your interior, to your whole truth. Feelings never lie. The body cannot deceive. If you want to find out what you believe about yourself and the world around you, look around at your life. It is the self-statement, the mirror of what exists inside you. When you feel preoccupied or disrupted internally, you'll probably notice that your house or office or car reflect that experience. All that you say in the syntax of thought, feeling, and behavior is about yourself. Remember, too, everyone else also makes self-statements. What you say about me doesn't tell me about me, it tells me about you. What someone says about you has everything to do with the speaker, even though it's focused on you. So, for clients, listen, take in new information, but don't take it personally. Remember, only a theory is ever this simple and clear. All others can do is share their experience of you. It's their experience and perception, their point of view. It tells you about them. You can share your own experience of someone else, but be aware that your perceptions are also filtered through your own lens. For example, if someone is being critical and judgmental of you, it's your decision whether to believe and accept that point of view. Consider if you're assigning an aspect of yourself to someone else, such as competitiveness. If you believe you lack a certain quality, you may focus on someone who exhibits it. The reliance on someone functioning for you or on an external point of reference for validation can be limiting. So in order to grow, you need to move your point of reference to an internal one, to own responsibility for your life and its expression. Listen for repetitions of the old story. And what I mean by that is that we each generate a life story with a recurring plot. We repeat its continuing formula over time, even if it's not a winning one. Each repetition may be more deep, may more deeply reinforce basic assumptions and a false belief that you're a victim of fate. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious will most likely be attributed to fate. To re-enter an old story and attempt to write a better ending creates a variation of the same scenario. It's a new edition of the same process. Repeating an old story to write a better ending, 1,000 better endings later, you're still recreating the process of the old story and etching it further in your mind and brain each time. The more you run away from something, the more you engage it. Because when you're running away from something, just like denial, you're engaging it in a powerful way. You know, it's kind of like saying that hate is as powerful an attachment as love is. It's a powerful emotion. Negative or positive, it's still a powerful attachment. At times, we repeat just to see in relation to fixed point of reference, how much we change. Each time we return to the chorus of a song, the repetition is satisfying, but those same words are different because more of the lyrical story is unfolded, and we see more of the evolving journey at each juncture of repetition. You probably had the experience of going back to some childhood place and noticing how different it is now, how much bigger it seemed. I went back to the auditorium where I did like one-act plays and various things, and I was amazed at how small that was, because that seemed like, at the time, like the whole world was out there. And, of course, it was my whole world at the time. But, you know, to revisit something and get a different perspective. Remember this, too. We're always reaching our goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious, so it's helpful to know exactly what they are. If your personal or professional life is not as gratifying as you want, then if you believe you've not attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know consciously and specifically what the goals are. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically yet dream vaguely? And that can even include something practical like this. Do you each have a business plan for your coaching practice? Another example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. The reason that about 95% of people who diet and lose weight gain back that weight, and often a little bit more, is they don't revise their body image. They don't change the software underlying that. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. So listen to the language in regard to your goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says that it's not a full commitment, a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. Now, you know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When somebody says, well, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of somebody committed. I will. And as coaches, we build in accountability by asking, by when? Or SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end for nine. And finally, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well, at the time and especially later. Now, we're going to return to this in Module 10 about wellness story, but here's a prologue. Listen to somatic language, to the message in each pain, discomfort, dis-ease, change of function, exhilaration, sensation, energy spurt. There are no accidents within the system, the story of your body. As with any complex system, a change of one component affects every aspect of that system. Of the body's 11 systems, only two have memory, the nervous and immune. A new story involving your body inscribes a new text for these two systems and benefits your whole body. Now, here's a final thought, kind of a suggestion in a way. To schedule two appointments with yourself, and the passive version is if I find time, to schedule an appointment with yourself to meditate and also to brainstorm. And those are two different times because they're two different states of mind. Here's a suggested prompt for the brainstorm session. Everyone on earth has one thing in common. Our choices in life define us. Those who provide service to others, authors, money managers, therapists, leaders, teachers, coaches, especially parents, have their answers counted many times. What will yours be? Make it matter. Okay, well, let's do a discussion. I'm interested in your take on this and the things that that you'd like us to talk more about or discuss yourself about applications of this. And first, if it makes sense to you, and what else would be helpful for us to talk about?
This has something to do with what you just said. Is that prompt anywhere else in the book? Because I didn't.
No, it's not. As I mentioned, I will not reiterate what's in the curriculum, but really extend and apply it. And the things that that I mentioned are essentially not in the curriculum, but are applications and related.
Can you repeat
the
prompt then, Dr. Kruger?
Can we what?
Repeat the prompt.
Sure. To schedule two brainstorming sessions, one to meditate, one to brainstorm, and the prompt for the brainstorm session. Everyone on Earth has one thing in common, and that's that our choices in life define us. Those who provide service to others, and I think the examples I gave were money managers, authors, therapists, teachers, leaders, coaches, especially parents, have their answers counted many times. What will yours be?
Okay.
And make it matter. And think about how few people have their answers counted so many times as we do. And I think that's why it's so important for us to be very clear about our story, our purpose, our why. And that will help us to work with people to be a more effective catalyst for each person in developing their own story and finding their true story for themselves and whatever storylines they want to work on: money, career, wellness, relationship, their individual life story. Yeah, thanks for the clarification. And you know, one Aristotle put it in a particular way, and I can't remember exactly how I said it. It's elegant, and I'll look it up and get it to you. But whatever we can choose to do, we can choose also not to do it. And that's part of our story. What we choose and what we choose not to do are both components of our story. And sometimes, and this is especially for people who are habituated or even addicted to something, the hardest thing to do is nothing, to not act or to not engage in an addictive process, whether that's a person, a substance, anything, shopping, a process, you know? Other thoughts and things that appeal to you to talk about are things that might be helpful in applying this to coaching for you?
I really appreciate the way that you use your, when you were mentioning your coaching sessions, you always use story. Is that something that we would be able to do as well? I mean, we can, right? I guess we're going to.
And I do it to give an example of how I think it can be meaningful. I believe, but first of all, the principle is stories are how we understand, how we make sense of things, and they're how we remember. Whatever we remember is connected to a story. Remember Watson from Watson and Crick said, you know, I can remember something if it's part of a story. Because that's the way our brains work. Our brains need and require a story. So a story often brings something into balanced learning. And by that I mean the story is often the emotional component, the right side of the brain. The principle or the lesson is the left side. So bringing together the right and left brain is balanced learning. So that's what makes it memorable. The first mentoring, the second mentoring that I did when I made my transition from therapy and analysis to coaching. My first mentoring was with a mentor coach who had made a similar transition, someone who was very well known in the mental health field, internationally and nationally. And I worked with her for several months in the transition. The second specific mentor I worked with was a storytelling mentor, and he had a story that he told me about when he was passing through an airport in Chicago, passing through O'Hare. Someone stopped him and said, "Doug, I just wanted to tell his name is Doug Stevenson. Doug, I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed the presentation that you did." And it was 4 years ago. And he said, "Do you mind me asking, What was it that I talked about?" And she said, "Oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told." So that's how, when you do presentations, I think presentations need to evolve around a story. Look at any of the TED Talks. They're a story. They're a collection of little stories, but they're one bigger story. Look at any, go to Barnes & Noble or your independent bookseller, and go to the nonfiction rack and grab any title that appeals to you. And here's a bet, a slam dunk bet. I'll bet that that book, chapter one, begins with a story.
Either the how they came to write the book or something, but yeah.
Not how they came to write the book, but a story that engages somebody for the process of what the book is about. The title tells themselves, the subtitle tells you the benefits you're going to get, but chapter one is going to begin a story that will illustrate some immersion in the process. The chapter one in Secret Language of Money begins with a story about a baseball that somebody caught and auctioned off. And, you know, I've been told it's a grabber. I mean, it grabbed me, and I wanted to pass it on. So the idea is to, I would say, become proficient at storytelling. Because that's how, I mean, I will, and that's why I love working as an executive mentor coach even more than I did as an analyst. And I didn't think I could have any more fun at all than doing that and working with the people I was privileged to work with. I will tell stories to clients just as I'm telling them to you in our training, because if a story will illustrate a process, it makes it memorable. It makes it something that really crystallizes some principles that are often useful to look at and to illuminate and illustrate a point. So yeah, the short answer is yeah, I'll definitely tell stories whenever I feel it would help someone along. There are a lot of things.
Not only,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Not only telling the story, but using. But you also approach their lives as a story.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, and that's what we're doing here in this training.
Right.
Is.
And so we're going to be
exactly
able to use. I think that's. You know, a lot of people come. A lot of people mention short stories. You know, I mean, that's a part. Like, if they know that they're a part of a story, like, I'm going to write the next chapter of my life.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll say things like that, but they don't really understand that their life is a story or how
right.
It is a story.
Right.
So I think that's a great approach. And
I really
like this.
Everything that I have learned about writing in all the years that I've been a student of writing really applies to how we write our own stories. You heard all the analogies that I just made about, you know, passive and active language. You know, point of reference, all the things that tell about the teller. The story always tells about the teller, and that's what we can listen for and help someone develop that reflective capacity to listen for it themselves. And it can be very powerful and engaging for someone to do that because they can then feel effective. And I think the goal in mind in the beginning is for someone to no longer need us, that they have internalized the process in an ongoing way so that they're able to do it then on their own. And that truly is self-functioning. So we're facilitating and fostering everything that self comes in front of: reflection, validation, regulation, a big one that we're going to spend some time on in looking at states of mind, I'm not sure which seminar it is, but module four, we're going to spend some time on that, including self-esteem, as we touched on today. all are affected by what we do, because we're affecting something as fundamental as someone's identity of who and what they are, the model that they're operating on, which needs to change as well as their behavior to make change that lasts. Yeah, other thoughts? The book that Doug Stevenson has written, he has some of his workshops on CD, which I'd recommend if you want to go in for that. But there's a book called Storytelling Theater that is by Doug Stevens. It really is a composite of a bunch of his ideas and notions that I think is really good. Well, other thoughts and questions? We still have 3 or 4 minutes. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
Just a question about our assignment for next week. Do we look at Module 2 now, or is that
yes.
going to be?
Yes.
Okay,
you'll see in the syllabus the title of the seminar and the reading out to the right, the corresponding.
I think I didn't download the syllabus. I downloaded the I don't think so.
There are three things to download and to print. One is the outline, the other is the syllabus, and the other is the 28-week protocol, and we'll talk about that as we move along. So those three things I think would be helpful to have printed in addition to the curriculum.
All right.
And they're all on the same page that you'll find the recordings of the seminars.
Okay. I'll go back.
I'm sorry?
I'll go back and download them now.
Okay. All right. Great. Yeah. If you have any trouble finding it, let me know.
Okay.
But they're all accessible from that page where the recordings will be, and the three downloads are accessible from the same page, the page you were directed to when you signed up.
Okay.
Yeah. What else? Again, if you can create the time to do the exercises, or at least the ones that really grab you, I think it would be helpful, because it'll give you an idea of what it would be like for your clients to do it and to see which might be useful to you for particular clients. Or what it would be like just to do the exercises as parallel if you want to do groups. What I've done in a number of instances and a number of people have done is to use the client workbook as a group in a group to do, you know, to have, and that's what the 28-week protocol is. You'll see the assignments there, or the suggested reading for each of the 28 weeks from the client workbook. So you have created an instant, time-limited group coaching with corresponding material and resources by the client workbook, and you'll see the corresponding time. And that can be expanded or contracted depending on the interest of the group. I've had groups who have only wanted to do the group coaching around the wellness story, for example, or some only around career story. So it can be any mix of that you find useful, but just to get an idea of what it's like for you to do the exercise yourself as you go through it.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I look forward to picking up with you next time. If there are any questions, be sure and let me know. Drop me an email or jot them down, and we'll talk about it at the beginning of next time. So I hope you have a great rest of the week. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. You too.
Bye now. See ya.
Bye.